4. It is his duty to prepare and to submit to the President a general financial statement relating to the accounts of each year, showing balances and outstanding liabilities, and such other information as may be required by the President. 5. It is duty to A. audit and report on all expenditure from the revenues of the Union and States. B. to see that the financial rules and orders which have a bearing on governmental expenditure are duly observed. C. to give such information and assistance to the Union government and state governments as may be required for the presentation of annual financial statements. D. to satisfy those who can sanction the expenditure have the power to do so. E. to examine the accounts from the standpoint of economy. F. to draw the attention of the Public Accounts Committee regarding the wastage and extravagance. 6. Article number 151 provides that the reports of the comptroller are of great value to safeguard the interests of the taxpayer. Audit is the watchdog of the finances of the nation, and comptroller is the supreme overseer of the governmental financial activities. Thus, the Auditor General is responsible for the accounts not only of the Union, but also states. He submits his report to the President and Governors annually. These reports are laid before both the Houses of Parliament and are examined by the Public Accounts Committee of the Lok Sabha. Thus, the Auditor functions as an agency of legislative control over public finance, not only of the Union, but also of the states. Role. The Comptroller and Auditor General of India plays an important role and acts as an extended arm of Parliament in controlling public expenditure. His report is most impartial and based on factual data. This is so because he is free from any kind of pressures. T.G. Bowles calls him as the acting hand of the Public Accounts Committee. At the sittings of the committee, he is invariably advises the committee and to help it in extracting the right type of replies from the officials who are called to defend the audit objections. In the words of Ashok Chanda, his functions are not merely to ensure that the appropriations made by Parliament have not been exceeded without a supplementary vote, but also to satisfy himself on behalf of Parliament as its wisdom, faithfulness, and economy. In addition, he upholds the Constitution and the laws in the spheres of financial administration. The receipts from income tax, wealth tax, expenditure tax, estate duty, excise and land revenue are excluded. The income tax receipts are now being progressively brought under his purview. The Comptroller and Auditor General is thus engaged in the scrutiny of the financial affairs of the Executive and submits his report to the Parliament, to which alone he is responsible. In the case of the state, his report is laid before the state legislature. Appleby's criticism. The Indian audit system is unsparing. He seems to be allergic to audit. His observations are intensely coloured. In India, the relation between the auditor and the executive is not too happy. Audit continues to be considered as something alien. Separation of accounts from audit. In India, the twin functions of maintenance of accounts and their audit have remained combined in the same hands until 1976. The comptroller was entrusted with both sets of functions. The arrangement under which the spending authorities are not responsible for the maintenance of a complete and up-to-date account relating to the transactions for which they are responsible. Delegated legislation. The emergence of delegated legislation is to rise of new disposition. Delegated legislation has become popular in modern democracies which have undertaken multifarious functions. Meaning, delegated legislation refers to the law-making power vested with the executive by the legislature itself. This is known as executive legislation. Law-making power of the executive is called subordinate legislation. The executive makes use of this power through the issue of rules. The rules made by the executive have the force of laws and are enforceable by courts of law. This rulemaking power is termed as delegated legislation. Thus, delegated legislation means the exercise of rulemaking power by the executive. For example, Parliament passes the bill in skeleton form and delegates the authority of rulemaking to the minister concerned. The term delegated legislation is used in two senses. One, it refers to the powers delegated to the executive to fill in the gap through rules. And two, it means the output of exercise of that power or rules, regulations, orders, etc. Delegated legislation is strictly a subordinate one. Reasons for the growth of delegated legislation. The delegated legislation has become almost a universal phenomenon. It has certain factors which have contributed a great deal towards this development. They are as under. With the impact of science and technology, the functions of the state have got multiplied. This has led to the growth of legislature which cannot cope up with it. This has compelled to delegate some of its powers to the executive. The pressure of work and the lack of time induced the legislature to delegate legislative authority to the executive. 2. Legislature of layman. The average legislator is a layman. He is not competent to deal with matters. He lays down only general principles and leaves the technical details to be filled up by the departmental heads. For example, the Parliament may place restrictions on the sale of poisonous substances, but may leave the compilation of these to the experts of medical and health department. 3. Flexibility. Law requires amendments with the change of times. Parliament is not always in sessions. Hence, it cannot adopt the law to the changing conditions. Therefore, it enables to delegate the authority to make alterations in the law whenever necessary. 4. To provide for unforeseen contingencies. Unforeseen emergencies like war, famine, economic crisis, natural calamities or epidemics require prompt action. It is not desirable to wait for the sessions of Parliament to meet such emergencies. Hence, the authority is delegated to the executive, which is always prepared to take action. 5. Legislature cannot foresee. If it is not possible for the legislature to foresee and include all the contingencies in the law because of complex matters, hence, this is left to the departments to be regulated as and when the opportunities arise. 6. Setting of new standards. Delegated legislation needs setting up new standards in the social interest. It ensures the national minimum of health, education, housing and sanitation. A right decision on such matters necessitates the application of rules which can be made by the experts of the concerned departments. 7. Awareness. The administrator is better aware of the requirements of the situation. He can draft rules in the light of what is administratively feasible. The laws passed by the legislature are not concerned with administrative feasibility. Many a time, even the administrator himself finds himself in a dilemma. For example, the legislature will pass a Motor Vehicle Act, but the traffic rules are made by the regional transport officer. Hence, there is a growth of delegated legislation. Types of delegated legislation. 1. Contingent type. This type of delegated legislation takes place where the legislator applied on the occurrence of a certain contingent and delegates the powers to determine the existence of contingency to the administrative agency. 2. Supplementary. It fills up the details of law which has been passed by the legislature in a skeleton form. The following matters shall be governed by rules made by the government. For example, Zamindari Abolition Act provides for payment of compensation for land taken over by the government. But the procedure is followed for getting compensation in accordance with the rules made under the Act. 3. Interpretive type. It explains about the provision of law to which it relates. The power to issue rules to clarify the provisions of law may be given to the administrative agency by the law itself. Interpretive rules are not legally binding. But in countries like USA, the court will treat administrative interpretations as final. Merits. 1. It saves the time of the legislature. The legislature has no time to make laws for regulation. Hence, it delegates some of its powers to the executive. It saves the time of the legislature and makes free from the burden. 2. Expert knowledge. The legislators are just laymen who lay down broad principles and objectives. The details are worked by experts. Delegated legislation helps in making use of the expert knowledge. 3. It makes flexibility. Delegated legislation makes flexibility. It is adaptable to the changing circumstances and time. 4. New experimentation. Delegated legislation makes new experimentation. Experimentation affords an opportunity to ensure experience, for example, town planning. 5. Unforeseen contingency. Parliament can hardly foresee the contingencies like flood, famine, epidemics, earthquakes, etc. But the officials are equipped with discretionary powers to deal with such situations. And 6. Proper drafting. Rule-making power is exercised by the experts. It is more perfect by the administrators. Thus, the delegated legislation is meaningful. Demerits. Despite its popularity, delegated legislation has been vehemently criticized by writers like Lord Hivart and C.K. Allen. Following are the points of criticism. 1. It leads to despotism. Delegated legislation leads to despotism. There may be possibility of arbitrary rule. Some English and American jurists have alarmed the development of new form of despotism. Lord Hivart, in his book New Despotism, argued that the growth of delegated legislation and administrative adjudication have combined the three powers into the hands of administration. 2. Too much flexibility. The advantage of flexibility in delegated legislation may bring about instability and chaos by frequent changes in the rules and regulations. It also leads to confusion. 3. Politically feasible. Rulemaking by administrators may overlook what is politically feasible. The officials may not be able to see what the people would swallow. With this, people's interests are ignored. 4. Inadequate and unsatisfactory rules. The arrangements for publication of rules may be inadequate and unsatisfactory. Generally, people will suffer from this. The interests of the people are adversely affected. 5. It determines democratic principles. The power of taxation is delegated one. Such a delegation undermines democratic principles. And 6. Jurisdiction of the court ousted. Delegated legislation seeks to oust the jurisdiction of the courts. It results in depriving the citizens from judicial protection. The rules made thereunder shall not be questioned in any court of law. Safeguards of delegated legislation. There are certain safeguards to rename the drawbacks of delegated legislation. They are as under. 1. Proper limits. Parliament should be subject to well-defined limits. It must not be vague and sweeping. 2. Normal purposes. Delegation of legislative power made for normal purposes, for example, to impose taxation. 3. Judicial power. Delegated legislation is to be safeguarded by the courts. The functioning of the courts is to see that the exercise of the delegated authority is not in excess of the terms of the delegation. If it exceeds, then the rules made by the executive shall be declared null and void. 4. Publicity and consultation. The rulemaking procedure should provide for publicity and consultation with public and special interests affected. 5. Parliamentary control. The parliamentary control over delegated legislation is a proper safeguard against the abuse of power by the executive. 6. Confidence. Legislative power should be delegated only to the trustworthy authority which commands general confidence. All the above said safeguards must be given due weightage, without which the executive might become despotic and liberty of the people may be at stake. Administrative adjudication. Modern public administration has taken a leaf not only from the legislature's book, but also from that of the judiciary. Administrative adjudication is the latest addition to the administrative techniques. It means the determination of questions of a judicial or quasi-judicial nature by an administrative department. Administrative bodies hear the parties, sift evidence, pronounce a decision in cases where legal rights and duties are involved. Definitions. Professor L. D. White says, administrative education means the investigation and setting up of a dispute involving a private party on the basis of a law and fact by an administrative agency. Professor DeMock says, administrative adjudication is the process by which administrative agencies settle issues arising in the course of their work when legal rights are in question. There are some agencies of administrative adjudication, such as 1. The minister, 2. The head of the department, 3. Ministerial tribunal, 4. Special committee like independent regulatory commissions, 5. Specialized courts of law, 6. Single member tribunal, 7. Composite tribunal, etc. There is a difference between administrative adjudication and administration of justice by the courts. Administrative justice is administered by administrative agencies and not by regular courts. The administrative courts follow the principle of natural justice, but the courts of law follow the settled principles of law and evidence. Administrative courts are manned by officers of the executive branch, whereas judges are the members of the judiciary, independent of executive control. Administrative adjudication stands for determination of matter of judicial nature by administrative departments. The power to make rules and regulations is quasi-legislative, and the power to settle the disputes by the administrative agencies is a quasi-judicial. Such powers may be vested in the executive department or officials on the tribunals. In India, departmental heads are given the power of administrative adjudication. For this purpose, some administrative tribunals have been established. For example, Income Tax Appellate Tribunal and Land Tribunals. These tribunals hear complaints, take evidence, find facts, and give decision. Causes for the growth of administrative adjudication. Following causes have led to the growth of administrative adjudication. 1. Welfare state. Modern states are welfare states. During the 18th and the 19th centuries, laissez-faire ideas held sway. Law courts arose as guardians of the rights and liberties of the citizens. But with the rise of welfare state, the emphasis shifted from individual rights to social interest. The judiciary is unable to uphold the new system. Hence, there is a growth of administrative adjudication. Expansion of state activities. On account of the expansion of state activities and ever-widening volume of legislation, the number of disputes involving highly technical issues increased in the industrial, social, and economic spheres. These disputes could not be settled by law courts fairly and speedily, as the judges were not well acquainted with the technicalities of administration. 3. Number of situations. Large number of situations arise in these days, require immediate decision, otherwise they may jeopardize the health and safety of the people. For example, safety measures in coal mines, illegal transactions in foreign exchange, and unfair business practices. In all these situations, there is delay in the regular course of law, which may cause loss to the public exchequer and natural prestige. But the administrative tribunals would ensure prompt and fair action. 4. Cheap and timely justice. Administrative adjudication brings cheap and timely justice to the people. The judicial procedure is costly and dilatory. It is beyond the means of common man, but administrative tribunal is simple and brief. There is no formalities of law, suits, pleadings and cross-examinations. A simple complaint without payment of court fee would initiate the adjudicative proceedings. 5. Flexibility. Administrative adjudication has brought about flexibility and adaptability in the judicial and administrative justice. The legal approach to the problems is static. A court can intervene only when a conflict arises. But administrative adjudication is a dynamic system and is flexible. 6. Simple procedure. At present, there is a tremendous rise in litigation that the ordinary law courts cannot cope up with. This work may affect the organization and working of law courts seriously. If the courts are put entirely to that work, they will not be able to dispose it off even in one full year. Administrative tribunals with their simple procedures are better to adjudicate the cases. It is only the administrative agency which can give due weightage to the considerations of social or economic policy. But the development of administrative adjudication was not accepted by the people of democratic countries. They are of the opinion that certain safeguards are essential if the rule of law and liberty of the subjects are to be maintained. Merits. 1. Flexible. Administrative adjudication is simple and flexible. A court can intervene only when conflict arises. But administrative adjudication is dynamic and serves the complex needs of modern society. 2. Speedy justice. Administrative adjudication gives speedy justice. Quick decisions are possible. 3. Cheap justice. Administrative adjudication is very cheap compared to law courts. The law courts are cumbersome and litigation is costly. It involves payment of huge court fees and requirement of lawyers. But administrative adjudication requires no stamp fees and no lawyers. Hence, its procedure is simple and cheap. 4. Adequate justice. In the changing world of today, administrative tribunals are not only appropriate but also most effective means of giving fair and adequate justice to the individuals. 5. Relief to courts. It gives relief to law courts. And 6. Sources of information. The administrative tribunals can be used as sources of information. They can hold inquiries and arrive at good decisions. Demerits. 1. It is a negation of the rule of law. Rule of law ensures equality before law for everyone. But administrative tribunals put a serious limitation upon the principles of the rule of law with their policy and procedures. 2. It has no set procedures. It violates the principles of natural justice. Hence, it does not inspire public confidence. 3. It holds summary trials and do not follow any precedent. In fact, administrative law is in a medley of confusion and uncertainty. 4. There is no uniformity in the procedure. In certain cases, tribunals are arbitrary and inconsistent in their decisions. 5. It provides poor quality of investigation of facts. There is no cross-examination. It is not a judicial way to arrive at true facts, and attendance of witnesses is lacking. 6. It leads to miscarriage of justice because the opportunity for judicial review is restricted. Conclusion. However, these defects cannot be eliminated from the system of administrative adjudication. Proper safeguards are to be provided to avoid these defects. Safeguards. There are 3 important safeguards of administrative adjudication. 1. Organization. The first safeguard of administrative adjudication is that of organization. There should be adjudication boards or tribunals rather than a single officer. The tribunals should be comprising of judges, eminent lawyers, academicians, and persons reputed in different walks of public life. 2. Procedure. There should be rules of procedure, namely, no man shall be a judge in his own case. No man should be condemned and unheard. A party should know the reasons for the decisions. And 3. Judicial review. There should be judicial control over the action of the administrators and tribunals. The right to judicial review on points of law should remain unimpaired. Public personal administration. The new organizational theory stresses the human aspects of administration. The theory seeks an equilibrium between organizational demands and individual self-realization. Personnel move the administrative machinery in the country. Public administration is a human problem. Hence, efficiency of administration depends on the qualities of human beings who operate the administrative machinery. No activities of public administration can be conducted without a competent personnel. The term personnel stands for civil service. It indicates a large number of civil servants who actually manage the affairs of the state. They are considered to be the backbone of administrative structure in all the countries. Types of personnel system. Broadly speaking, there are three types of personnel system, namely bureaucratic, aristocratic, and democratic. 1. The bureaucratic system of personnel. Bureaucracy means a government by bureau or desk government. Technically, the term is used in two senses. In its broader sense, it is used to describe any personnel system where the employees are classified in a hierarchy of sections, divisions, bureaus, departments, and the like. In its narrower sense, it is a body of public servants organized outside the sphere of effective public control. In the words of Professor John A. Waig, bureaucracy denotes the sum total of the personnel, apparatus, and procedures by which an organization manages its work and achieves its purposes. In other words, it is a system of personnel under which all the employees are organized into a hierarchy of offices, each with a well-defined sphere of duties and responsibilities. Max Weber, a German sociologist, described it as a system of administration characterized by expertness, impartiality, and the absence of humanity. Max Weber's ideal type construct of bureaucracy depicts the picture of bureaucratic system of administration. It is a framework in the study of administration. Aristocratic system of personnel. This system began and developed in England and has now been adopted by India, France, and other Western countries. This system has its roots in the 18th century aristocratic democracy of England. 1. Grades. Features grades here is a sharp distinction between the different grades of personnel, and promotion from lower to the higher is either completely debarred or restricted. In England, the public services are divided into administrative class and executive class. In India, there are administrative services and secretarial and executive services. In India, secretaries, joint secretaries, and deputy secretaries are administrative heads, that is IAS cadre. 2. Career. It is also called professionalism in public administration. Prospective candidates are appointed at an early age and are then systematically trained and are entitled to promotion, emoluments, and retirement benefits. 3. Educational qualification. It determines the general mental attainment of the candidate rather than any special expert knowledge, as in USA. This factor was emphasized by Lord Macaulay and Trevelyan, the founders of this system in England. The democratic system of personnel. This system of personnel is prevalent in the United States of America. It is because of their love for democratic principles and their rich economic life. It is called democratic bureau. It is based on democratic principles, that is, no one man has any more intrinsic right to official station than another. Features. 1. Age. The age requirements are such: 18 years to 35 years, even 45, that persons all along their life may enter public services. 2. No classes. There is no class division in the service. An employee may begin in the lowest grade and may be promoted to the top. Promotions are based on records. There is no restriction on promotion. 3. Technical training. It is fitting them to perform the work called by the particular positions to be filled. And 4. Not life career. No effort is made to make public service a life career. Every individual has a full freedom to enter government service at any stage. People get special education and training in private institutions and small industries, then enter into public service. If they choose, may shift to higher private industries. Foundations of personal system. The modern personal system is classified into 4 types. They are tenure system, merit system, career system, and position classification. 1. Tenure system. Every tenure system has a definite tenure of office for its employees. There are 3 tenure systems, namely tenure according to the will of the appointing officer, tenure for fixed term of years, and tenure during good behavior. For administrative services, the first one is not suited as it causes severe hardships to the employees. The second system also does not suit the administrative offices because short terms never attract capable persons for specialization. Third system does not provide incentive to hard and efficient work. But the third system, tenure during good behavior, has the following advantages. 1. It secures permanence of office to the employee, which increases proficiency in the employee and efficiency in the administration. 2. It makes government service a permanent career, a profession. 3. It helps in securing to the state the services of capable and interested persons. 4. This system is coupled with a proper system of promotion. Further, it provides incentives for efficient work. Value of the system. Today it has become a deep grounded foundation of the personal system in every well governed country. Merit spoils system of person. According to this system, the selection and conditions of service of the employee should be based on merit of the candidate. As opposed to the merit system, there is a spoils system, which means the public office is considered as a spoil to be enjoyed by the political party victorious at the polls. A candidate appointed on political considerations cannot hope to stay when the opposite party has secured victory at the polls. That means the life tenure system cannot work under the spoils system. The position who is appointed on the basis of merit will have efficiency. The candidate's capability is examined through competitive examination on the basis of education. These examinations are conducted by the Public Service Commission. Merit system is better than spoils system. Advantages. 1. It is free from corruption and favoritism. 2. The candidates are appointed in the atmosphere of political neutrality and equal opportunity. 3. Only efficient and meritorious candidates will have a chance to enter the public services. 4. It provides service security. 5. Employees remain loyal to the government. Career personal system. Making government service as a permanent career is another foundation of the civil service system. The term career was defined by the Commission of Inquiry on Public Service this personal appointment in 1933 by the U.S. Social Science Research Council. It means the steps shall be taken to make public employment a worthwhile life work, with entrance to the service open and attractive to young men and women of capacity and character, an opportunity of advancement through service. The welfare state needs class of administrators. It is necessary to build up such a class of officials. Therefore, due recognition of ability and personal efficiency has to be given by way of a sound promotion system. Advantages. 1. It gives the state a class of workers who become competent, loyal, and happy members of a production team. 2. It gives security of service and guarantees due recognition of service and merit. 3. It gives the employees freedom from fear of want during their service and retirement time. 4. It ensures equality of opportunity. 5. It gives the employees an opportunity of serving the state loyally and industriously. In conclusion, it is to say that too much attachment to the career system is not in the interest of the state. If career system is limited in its application, it is a useful incentive to employees to develop in their fields. Position classification. Classification means grouping of positions into classes. The term position refers to a group of duties and responsibilities. Classification of position is very essential in the modern state. The position classification is as under. 1. It is devised to secure a close approximation of the principle equal pay for equal work. 2. Other phases of personnel are also aided by a good plan of classification and compensation. 3. It contains a detailed description of duties. 4. It serves as a basis for an orderly system of promotions and transfers. 5. It facilitates training programs and the system of service record or efficiency rating. 6. The classification plan tends to eliminate the specific salary legislation for employees. There are two major systems of position classification. A. Duties or positions, and B. Rank classification. A. Duties or positions. Position classification is based on duties or positions. It is found in the USA and Canada. Some of the operational features of the US system are summarized as follows. 1. The Classification Act sets forth a statutory schedule consisting of 18 grades applicable to all service positions. It gives their general level of responsibility and prescribes salary limits. 2. The positions are allocated to certain class on the basis of which classes of position are assigned to a grade. 3. Each position is analyzed in a job description showing the duties of the post. 4. Positions are allocated to classes and then assigned to grades on the principle that positions involving similar kinds of work and responsibility. 5. The department administrates the classification scheme through their offices under the control of the U.S. Civil Service Commission. B. Rank classification. Rank classification has been adopted by many European countries. Rank concept is the status of pay, prestige, rights, etc. This system makes it easy to utilize the services of an employee wherever necessary without in any way jeopardizing his job or career prospects. Advantages. 1. Rank in the employee gives a greater sense of security. 2. It tends to be more flexible. It emphasizes generalists rather than specialists and facilitates transfer from within the service. 3. It simplifies the drafting of personal regulations and the imposition of budgetary controls as applied to a group of or cadre of positions. And 4. It does not influence the educational system to adapt itself to its determinant by devotion from the lines of the educational system. Position classification in India. In India, civil service is divided into classes and posts. A certain rank, status, and privileges are ascribed to the civil servants as also to a post. All posts are classified as soon as they are created. The classification has to indicate the class of the post, whether it is ministerial or non-ministerial. The distinction is that ministerial servants belong to a subordinate service whose duties are clerical. The central secretary post in class 1, including those of section officers and assistants, and clerical posts in class 3 are considered ministerial, and all other classes are non-ministerial. Civil posts are further categorized as gazetized or non-gazetized. The various services are classified as follows. 1. Services under the rule-making control of the Government of India. And 2. Services under the rule-making control of the state government. The present system of services, both vertical and horizontal. The public personnel are classified into classes as well as services. There are 4 classes in descending order: class 1, class 2, class 3, and class 4, corresponding to differences in the responsibility of the work performed and the qualifications required. Class 1 and class 2 include personnel performing higher administrative and executive responsibilities in the government. Class 3 is clerical personnel. Class 4 is the lowest in the hierarchy, includes peons, watchmen, carpenters, drivers, cooks, sweepers, etc., all engaged in manual work. Another classification is services. Public personnel are directly recruited to distinct services. They continue to be the members of that particular service until they retire or resign. The central government has 2 categories of higher civil services. 1. All India services, and 2. Central Civil Services. All India services include IAS, IPS, and Indian Foreign Service. All India services are Class 1 services. The Central Civil Services belong to Class 1 and Class 2 services. For example, Central Engineering Service, Central Health Service, Indian Postal Service, Indian Audit and Accounts Service, etc. are Class 1 services. Labor Officers Service, Postmaster Service, Central Excise Service, Telegraph and Traffic Service, etc. are Class 2 services. Class 3 includes UDC and LDC, and Class 4 includes peons, sweepers, etc. Bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is a system of government, the control of which is so completely in the hands of officials that their power jeopardizes the liberties of the people. This was said by Professor Lasky. The term bureaucracy may be traced to the French word bureau, means a writing table or desk. Thus, it is a desk government. Following the model is defined as government of the bureaus, by the bureaus, and for the bureaus. Used in this sense, the word bureaucracy develops a nasty air about it. Definitions. Encyclopedia Britannica. Bureaucracy signifies the concentration of administrative power in bureaus or departments and the undue interference by officials. John A. Waig says, through distortion and caricature, the term bureaucracy has come to imply bungling, arbitrariness, wastefulness, officiousness, and regimentation. F. M. Marx said, bureaucracy is a form of organization, more specifically as a general design for a conduct of public administration. Fiffner said, bureaucracy is a systematic organization of tasks and individualistic in a pattern which can most effectively achieve the ends of collective effort. Thus, bureaucracy is identified with rigid, mechanical, wooden, inhuman, formal, and soulless approach. Bureaucracy is a system of administration which a profession, class of expert civil servants administer the affairs of the state on the basis of rules and regulations. Features of bureaucracy. Following are the features of bureaucracy. 1. Hierarchical organization. Bureaucracy is used to denote a body of public servants organized in a hierarchical system which stands outside the sphere of effective public control. It is personally free and subject to authority only with respect to their impersonal official organization. They are organized in a clearly defined hierarchy of offices. The office is filled in by a free contractual relationship. 2. Technical specialization. The civil servants are selected on the basis of technical qualifications and specialization. In the most rational case, this is tested by examination or guaranteed by diplomas, certifying technical training, or both. 3. Career service. Bureaucracy constitutes a career. They are recruited on a permanent basis and continue till the age of retirement. There is also a system of promotion according to seniority and achievement, or both. The Commission of Inquiry defined a career as an honorable occupation which one normally takes up in youth with the expectation of advancement and pursues until retirement. Willoughby defined that bureaucracy is a career system that offers equal opportunities to all citizens to enter government service, equal pay or work in the same degree of intelligence capacity, equal opportunities for advancement and equal participation. 4. Political neutrality. Public servants serve the government and not a particular party. The fortunes of civil services should not be connected with the rise and fall of political parties. Neutrality in politics is necessary for maintaining the integrity and efficiency of administration. Political neutrality is the hallmark of Indian administrative service. A civil servant is debarred from indulging in political activities. Permanence of tenure and peaceful contented stay at a station necessitates aloofness from politics.